And from high atop the cliffs of Bodega Bay, California, it's the HR Examiner Radio Hour, the best half hour of recruiter talk online. I'm John Sumser, your host, and I'm the editor of the HR Examiner. If you're not a regular reader, go to hrexaminer.com and sign up. Today, we're fortunate to have Michael Long, a.k.a. the Red Recruiter, as our guest. Michael is a legend in employment branding circles, having unearthed the original brand inside of Rackspace, and he is now taking a sabbatical and spending some time as a rock cutter. So we're going to dig into employment branding with Michael Long. And how's it going, Michael?
It's going well. How are you doing, John?
Oh, I'm great. This whole radio show thing is actually more fun than I ever would have imagined it being, and it's part of the next generation of stuff. So I want to jump right in, Michael. Tell me how you think about employment branding.
You know, I think that it's I've told the story a number of times, but when I first got interested in employment branding, I was a recruiter. I started my career in recruiting after college, and one of the early lessons I learned about recruiting was that people don't like being lied to. Shocker, right?
Yeah.
So it was just that simple kind of recognition early on that I think helped me find success in recruiting, and I carried it into the way that I managed accounts when I was on the agency side, the way that I ran branch offices when I was a branch manager, It was simply this. It's just that, look, we're all human. We all, you know, wake up in the morning. Nobody wakes up and says, hey, I want to be a failure today. But ultimately, people look for fulfillment, and work is a big part of that. So as I thought through this and started seeing some of the new technologies that were coming online, like Glassdoor.com and the way that communication was traveling so quickly, it became apparent that companies weren't going to be in a position where they could kind of bamboozle the potential talent on the market anymore. They would have to tell the real story. Yet I didn't see any companies, you know, making a large effort to do it. So as I continued to chat about it publicly and write about it a bit, there was an opportunity that came along to go try out the methodology and the approach of Rackspace. And so I did. And the whole point of the approach here, it became telling the story. Like what it meant to be a part of the organization, not in my words necessarily, but in the words of the people who were contributing. And I ended up calling this approach culture branding. And for about a couple of years, I spoke about it in different places in the U.S. and abroad. But culture branding to me, again, just to break it down, it's telling the true story of the organization and avoiding, you know, the hype as much as possible and realizing that for the right person, your workplace is the perfect place.
Okay. So I get that in a way, and I don't get that in a way. A lot of the people who I see talking about employment branding are talking about color palettes and consistency and message and some sort of message theming. How do you make those two things go together? Because I think they're both part of the picture, right?
Yeah, you know, look, I don't think that you want to provide a bad experience for people when they're showing up and taking a look at your company. So definitely putting your best foot forward. But at the same time, you don't do it at the cost of not getting to the meat and potatoes of what it is that people are showing up to see. So when I say that, what I'm meaning is, yes, you know, it's good to have consistent messages, but it shouldn't be that you're just working to get a consistent message. It should be that you're looking to find what the true message is within the organization. The other thing I noticed was that when I was reading early on about employment branding, one of the most common issues that was popping up is that an organization would create an employer value proposition and it'd become obsolete. Well, of course it would. It's obsolete probably the day after it's created because the culture of an organization constantly shifts. And so if you're focusing on just that message and just the goal of consistency as opposed to, you know, what's relevant, what's real time, I think it's easy to get lost in the strategic measures necessary to carry out a brand instead of actually being engulfed in what the story is and making sure you're sharing it. So it's just a matter of priorities, I think.
Well, that's actually what a great insight. So employment brands describe cultures that are constantly in flux, and they're evolving and they're shifting and they're adapting to the realities of the market that they live in. If you're sort of orchestrating the employment branding initiative in a company, how do you stay on top of that?
Yeah, look, I'll be honest, it takes a ton of work. In the beginning, I was alone at Rackspace. I was, you know, kind of a one-person show trying to carry it off. I did, so when I started, there was a gentleman by the name of Paul Norman. He's now he heads up recruiting for North America for Wyndham. But he was the one who originally brought me in, and him and I worked together heavily on, you know, figuring out the strategy and putting it in play. But it was the tactical work to bring the stories together, to recruit the contributors or bloggers across the organization, to, you know, do things like send them reminders about writing that story. And I found oftentimes, you know, you would ask, and this always seemed to happen with the best people, right? Is you'd ask them to write a story or to tell their story about what had happened or their experiences. And, you know, they never think that they're all that important, right? They don't think their stories are going to want to be read all that much. And so it does take encouragement. And the other thing to consider is that not everybody's a writer. So there is some stage fright, per se. And so being able to sit with them and talk through how they, you know, what they want to say and how they want to say it without putting it in your own words but keeping it in theirs is also a challenge. And a lot of organization in the beginning. And look, I mean, I think here's one of the things that I will say from a time perspective. I've seen a lot of folks who have, you know, attempted to jump into the employment branding realm or who are involved with it now who seem to consume the majority of their time working on this magical concept called social media. And the truth is that I never really focused on social media. I didn't spend time, like, reviewing Twitter cues and seeing if anybody, you know, mentioned working at Rackspace. Instead, I spent my time investing in the employees of the company, the Rackers, and really trying to dig in and find the stories. And so, look, I mean, it's easy to waste days looking through what people are saying everywhere, but you have to choose wisely, and I just thought that the best return on investment it would be the gathering of the stories.
So this is pretty cool. The notion that you're describing is that the employment branding leader is really the conductor of a symphony that's made up of people around the organization who are contributing their perspective to the overall thing, rather than some sort of Stalin-esque top-down mandated adherence to messaging thing. Does that work for every company, or is it unique to companies who trust their people?
That's a good question. You know, if the organization doesn't trust their people, there's bigger issues at play here. But ultimately, it's like, I mean, there is a real story at every company. You know, I've said this too before, and I remember early on I was speaking, I think it was like a TalentNet Live in Dallas, and there was an audience member that asked me, what do you do if you work in a toxic environment, right? And the first thing I said to her was, you quit. But then, you know, I thought about that question a lot afterwards because I thought, you know, even in an environment where there's issues, where things aren't flowing right, I still, or at least now, I look at that and say, look, there's a real opportunity to turn things around, okay? It's not all lost, per se. I think the question is, you know, is there going to be a pivot point in the organization where they say, okay, enough's enough. We know we have problems. Fine. Let's go find out, you know, because we still need to get talent. Let's go find out who's successful here, why they're successful here, why they stay, what fulfills them, and what's their story. How did they arrive? You know, what are the special things in this environment that actually they do kind of hang their hat on and tell their friends about? If you start getting to those truths, right, of the best performers of the, and not just best performers, but the best culture fits in the company, you start seeing something that's quite different. The picture that is able to be painted is one that, you know, you're sharing a message of who will be successful in this organization as opposed to, some canned speech about, you know, we want the best talent for X, Y, or Z. No, you don't just want the best talent. You want the best talent, the people who are actually going to stay. And so unless you're willing to find out who your key performers are that are doing well, like, yeah, you're missing half the story.
Okay. Does it matter if you're talking to accountants or technical people? Do you do this differently depending on the audience?
Yeah, I think I would just return the question and say, you know, do accountants have any less desire to be successful than, let's say, you know, a tech person or a finance person, HR person? I mean, everybody has motivators as to why they show up in the morning. And this is another thing that employment branding tends to do really well, is that they generalize so much that they try to create a central message that applies to everybody in their organization. But the truth is that in any organization, you have a collective culture, you have values that kind of run between people, kind of the pillars of your organization, and then you also have what you could call subcultures or microcultures, where there's different reasons sometimes as to why somebody's a part of that subculture, that micro, you know, environment within the company. And it may just be that in accounting, you know, every Friday they have a potluck, and you know, they get together and they share funny stories, and that might be a cultural piece specific to that group. So instead of avoiding it and not sharing it, my challenge was, hell, why don't we share it? Why don't we share this microcosm that's going on within the organization and show it off? You know, for the right accountant that shows up to our site that happens to read that story, it's going to resonate. And for the accountant that shows up that doesn't like that kind of thing, great. Like, we've helped, you know, make sure that they don't end up in a situation where they're unhappy. So that's
okay,
kind of how it looks.
That's cool. That's cool. That's consistent with what you've been saying so far. I want to sort of make you stretch out a little bit here. Excuse me. And ask about a hypothetical. So I know that you've done this in a well-known, sophisticated tech environment, and so you've got that perspective. But let's talk about recruiting technical people in a candy company, right? So maybe Mars has a small group of developers putting together the next M&M's app. And they are the lone nerds in an entire universe of chocolate heads. How is there a difference in the way that you think about this in that sort of setting versus a big tech company with a big reputation in technology?
Yeah, I think, you know, you bring a good point. So, but some of the pushback to this methodology is, been like, hey, it's too fluffy, or, you know, it's not scalable or applicable. But one of the things that, you know, does go on in the background is the actual strategy behind talent acquisition and the questions about, you know, what's the pipeline look like for next year? What type of talent are we going to need to bring in? Who are our key talent that we need to attract the most? And all these things. In a candy bar company that, let's say, has four IT people, the majority of your story searching or corporate anthropology probably isn't going to be spent on IT. It's going to be spent on the key skill sets that you need to attract the most of. Not to say there can't be flavor added, no pun intended, to the job description or the characterization of the position in IT, but I think it's a distribution of efforts issue, right? Like a candy company probably needs, maybe there's a production position that's, yeah, that's going to represent 50% of their hiring next year. So as the employment branding person, I would hope that the 50% of that time that they have is going to be spent looking for stories and working with that group that's already working in those roles, right? And just as if it's 1% that represents IT, you can imagine how that might change the amount of time that's invested there.
That's great. So I'm going to take a moment here and remind everybody in the audience that you're listening to the HR Examiner Radio Hour, the best half hour of recruiting news and wisdom on the internet. We're brought to you by DICE, the career hub for technical people. And we are talking with Michael Long, a.k.a. the Red Recruiter. So, Michael, what about technologies? You're talking about doing employment branding in a way that's got a lot of cat herding associated with it. You have to get people whose job it isn't to help with content generation. Are there technologies that you've used that make a difference in getting this right?
Yeah, I'd say so. I mean, it's not to ignore some of the other important factors of making sure that the brand gets out far, or that, you know, jobs are distributed correctly, or I leveraged a lot of different tools in the position there, everything ranging from Facebook social ad systems to LinkedIn, tested a lot of things to see kind of what the return looked like, did a lot of work with AdWords to find out, you know, look, based on the keywords and the searches that are going on, you know, what kind of audience could we touch, and then, you know, as a lot of people know, Jobs2Web became a strategic partner. They're now part of SuccessFactors. But utilizing their platform, I was able to kind of have faith that part of job distribution, the SEO behind all the job titles, the analytics platform for return on investment for different types of jobs, everything was taken care of at that point, so I could focus my efforts on more of the creative and storytelling piece of the quotient. And it was when we put that dynamic content, which was the career site, together with the Jobs2Web platform, which I guess you could say was the job site, when those things came together, that we had a well-oiled machine that grew, you know, in, geez, 2 years, it went from 150,000 visitors a year to was trending towards 1.3 million when I left. And so it was just kind of a well-oiled machine by that point, but those things all need to go together. And I wouldn't say an employment brander can only focus on the stories, and they also need to be able to take those stories and distribute them somehow. So having good content distribution channels is important. Don't know if I answered your question, but
yeah, well, that's great, because you raise a really interesting question in your answer, and that is, if you go from 100,000 visitors to 1.5 million visitors, there must be workload implications of that. What's it like to go through that level of growth in visitors? That must have been amazing. Yeah. What was that like?
So, look, I think, well, there was a lot of excitement tied to it, but I think that one of the biggest things was making sure that we were being as candid as possible, putting as, you know, the stories that were true, so that it wasn't just a question of acquiring more people to apply. It was the effort being, look, it's great there's more people showing up. We want to make sure that people are ruling themselves out if they're not a fit, too. So naturally, I mean, there was, you know, recruiting grew and all that over time, not all because of the efforts of employment branding, but, you know, really making sure that there's some infrastructure in place to deal with that increased load of people. And the other thing is, look, when you're getting, you know, hundreds of applicants per position, not everybody gets hired. And so this is an area that I think I'd heard about at Pepsi a while back, you know, like their silver medalist program, where sometimes the person that's runner-up is an excellent candidate for the organization. Having great follow-up mechanisms in place to reach back out to them is a very good idea. But we had a remarketing campaign set up within our system. So, you know, if somebody were to apply and let's say they didn't get hired or maybe didn't move through the process on that position, they would receive updates automatically about new positions that were opening up. And the return visitors to the site, you know, were quite high. We had people that sometimes would apply for, you know, 30 jobs before they would end up in a position. But yeah, I kind of like the tenacity behind that too.
That's amazing. So I'm gonna nudge a little forward and ask you, talk a little bit about what makes a branding campaign fail.
Look, I mean, I think what makes it fail is when you just go canned. I mean, anybody can say they have a great job available. Everybody says that, I think. Yeah, everybody has the best position ever right now for for the whole world.
Right, and we're looking for the superstar who's the best in the world to do it.
The A player to match up. And I don't think, you know, maybe in reflection, I think that the campaigns that I've seen, the ones that don't seem to stick as much, are when they're just generalized like that. I mean, look, this stuff's personal. Work is personal. People, you know, their lives are impacted by it. They go home and, you know, they have kids, and their happiness at work is very much so a part of how they, you know, relate to their families and society and everything else. So when it comes down to establishing a psychological contract with the person, you know, I think it's our duty to make sure that we're being honest. But also the side benefit of this is, like, look, instead of having to worry about doing job ad marketing, maybe start thinking about doing content marketing. If you, you know, have a great story from somebody that works for your organization, you know, hell, run an ad that's about the story, not simply about the job. And for the right people that read it, you know, it's going to resonate. They're going to apply. So I think that's, you know, again, what makes it fail is doing what everybody's always done.
Well, that's interesting. That's interesting. So I think what you're saying is that success in employment branding really means building a sort of a viral contagion about the company and amping up people's desire to work there based on what it's really like to be there. So that makes me wonder, if you've got a crummy company with a crummy work environment, how do you do employment branding for that?
So this is back to kind of the answer earlier, is that I think it's an opportunity to step back and say, okay, a lot of things aren't working, a lot of things are broken right now, but let's look at the people who are successful. Again, let's get the stories of the people who like it here, who are fulfilled, and why did they come here? Why did they stay here? You know, what are the things that happen in their work life that are important to them? And how can we get them to be a part of our recruiting efforts? If not any, you know, super tactical way of, like, picking up the phone and calling people, maybe at the very least, you know, you can get their stories and you can start sharing their personality. You attract more of what's successful, and, you know, ultimately I think the chances of the company being successful go up. And that, you know, the toxic environment or the, you know, the failure that's going on in the organization, you know, would hopefully decrease. You're getting more of what good looks like.
That's great. So you're doing some amazing stuff. I think anybody who's listening to this ought to think about taking your example and finding a sabbatical to chase after work that you love, just so that you have a taste of chasing after the work that you love. You're doing some stuff with rock cutting at, if I got it right, rightrocks.com. Tell me about that a little bit.
Well, you know, it's funny. I was kind of ready for a bit of a change, and my wife and I, so Kelly Long and I, were having our second child. We're living in Texas, and we love Texas, but, you know, having a second kid, we decided it would be good to be closer to family, so we moved out to Arizona, and I walked into my backyard, and I found these turquoise-colored rocks in my gravel. And to back up about a decade in college, I spent about 2 years shadowing a gemologist, jeweler, metallurgist, who, it was just fascinating work. I had actually thought about studying gemology at one point, but here I was, you know, over a decade later, walking into my backyard, and long story short, I found about 600 pieces of this stone called chrysocolla. And so I said, well, hell, you know, I'm taking some time to just kind of let my mind relax. I'm going to cut them. And so I cut my first stone and sold a piece within 5 days. It was a custom jewelry piece. And one thing led to another, and started making contacts and gaining mentors, and I've gotten pretty heavily involved with rocks. So, I do a lot of custom cutting for kind of private clients who want one-of-a-kind pieces, and I've, you know, learned how to build an e-commerce site from scratch, and so I've rolled out Right Rocks to sell to the wood inlay market and to a lot of the jewelry inlay. We're going to be selling raw stones, a semi-precious stone from around the world. But, every once in a while in life, it's good to take a step back, maybe look at things from a different angle, and it's taught me a lot. You know, working with your hands and, you know, hurting yourself and having to put so much damn cream on your hands so they don't crack is a little bit different than sitting at a desk and, you know, writing content. But there's this quote, actually, and I think it applies to culture branding as much as it applies to stonework. It's a quote from Michelangelo. It says, "I saw the angel on the marble and carved until I set him free." And for me, now that I'm doing so much stonework, this is a really appropriate quote. You never can control a rock, okay? A rock is what it is. But inside that rock, if you look enough and if you're delicate enough, you will set free something beautiful in it. So every single stone's like that. I think that it applies to an organization in the same way, and that's the employment brander's job, is to go in and look at that stone, that marble, and say, where's the angel in this? And what can I do to carve until I set it free? And if you set free that angel in your organization, the world takes note. And they come because they want to be there, because it's the best representation of what the rock could be.
That's brilliant. So what's it going to take you to get you to drop the rocks and come on back to recruiting?
So I don't know if I'll do recruiting per se, but something I've lost total interest in branding. I think nowadays I'd love to help clients if the right opportunity exists to develop out a strategy, to give them the how to's and what next of rolling out a full-out employment branding approach for their organization, for those organizations that are ready to, try something that's relevant, something that, they could really hang their hats on and be proud of. I think culture branding's a great approach. It's utilizing the most recent technologies, and also it's not BSing. It's getting to the heart of who their organization is. So the impacts of that are much greater than just the employment brand. From consistency and leadership messaging to the way that environmental art works. When I left Rackspace, I was running the culture and communication support team, so that was the functions of internal communication, videography, internal events. There was a graphic design component, employment branding, and all these were coming together really to aid the corporate culture, so a lot of corporate culture initiatives. But, I'll take a client here and there if there's an organization that's ready to get started.
That's great. So the new Michael Long tagline is, we unleash the angel in your organization.
I like that. That's good.
Yeah.
Creative, man.
Yeah, well, there you go. I would have sent you a bill at the end of the show, which is coming up momentarily. So I want to thank you for spending the time with me today, Michael. It was a pleasure, and I hope that the folks in the listening audience had a chance to get what I think is a powerful and unique view of how to do employment branding.
It's an honor to join you. Thanks for having me, John. I appreciate it.
Thanks. This is the HR Examiner Radio Hour, the best half hour of recruiting news and inspiration. It's been a pleasure having you all. Next week on the show, we'll have Heather Bussing to talk about the employment law issues associated with recruiting and technical recruiting. And I'm going to leave you now with our theme song. This is the HR Examiner Radio Show.